Welcome to the Donna Sebo Show. Donna is an international mental practitioner, award-winning author, counselor, speaker, teacher, and radio TV personality. Dedicated to empowering others through her mental skills, she also features authors and experts from all over the world to share their knowledge and experience with you, the listening audience. Now, let's join Donna and her guests. Here's Donna.
Hi, and welcome to an hour of mind power. This is Donna Sebo, and today we're going to start off with the making of miracles. That's right. How would you like to be able to create some new realities in your space, not just for yourself, but maybe for a lot of other people? Well, my guest today, Lynn Woodward, she is a woman that has a real passion for this. Lynn, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Donna. It's nice to be here. And just a slight correction, my name is Woodland, Lynn Woodland.
Woodland, I beg your pardon.
My error.
I know that you're an award-winning author. You have taught internationally, and you've been involved with transpersonal psychology, human motivation, and healing, mind-body psychology. And I'm just intrigued with why you have chosen to incorporate the term miracle, because usually when people incorporate that term, it has a particular picture in people's minds. What was it that made you say, I want to bring this into the awareness of people? Why was this important to you?
Well, really it started many, many years ago, back in the early 80s. My work had always had a spiritual flavor to it, and I was in a counseling setting working with transpersonal psychology. But I got involved with the work of Jerry Jampolsky, who started the Attitudinal Healing Center movement. And I just got very excited with what he was doing with children and adults dealing with life-threatening illnesses, teaching them this very simple philosophy of attitudinal healing, which he drew from A Course in Miracles, that basically is just bringing people together to live in the moment, let go of fear, and extend unconditional love. And he had he saw all these healing miracles happen with people who really weren't expected to get better, having spontaneous healings and that sort of thing. And so I started a center in the early 80s modeled after his, and we found the same thing, that something happened, both for the people who are dealing with illnesses as well as the able-bodied volunteers. Everybody just started seeing amazing things happening in their lives as they practiced this simple philosophy.
You
and that's when I got very
statement.
Interested in the whole idea of miracles, that things can happen in ways that defy a lot of what we've been taught to believe. You know, that was a long time before things like the law of attraction became buzzwords. And ever since, I've really dedicated my career to exploring what gives rise to miraculous experience and how can we have that become more of our normal.
All right. Now, you say something that people shouldn't stalk their miracles. And I thought, that's an interesting phrase. Don't stalk your miracles. What did you mean by that?
Well, I've seen so many people take up the latest success technique for using the power of intention to get everything they want in life and take it up with such seriousness. You know, their brow gets very strained as they visualize, and there's almost this attitude of I'm going to visualize it until it happens, if it kills me. And there's something in that that strain, that rather than calling things into our lives that can actually repel them. And I've seen some of these techniques work in ways that have a real comical kind of backlash. Like I remember one woman who really did just sit down and visualize the vehicle that she wanted to manifest. She did it three times a day, just religiously. And she did, in fact, manifest the vehicle, the exact color, the model, the make of everything, except she manifested it exactly the way she saw it. Somebody gave it to her as a free gift, but it had no engine. I mean, she manifested it just as she saw it, you know, sitting still in the driveway.
Mm-hmm.
And she got the outer form of what she wanted. She didn't get the internal essence. And that's what I see happening with people who take up these techniques and they pursue them in this, I'm going to make it happen. There's an attitude of lightness that needs to come into the process. And one of a metaphor that I use frequently for the perfect state for calling forth miracles is that of a butterfly landing in our hand. And just imagine that for a moment. You know, this little butterfly comes and lights in your hands, and your body is still, your mind is quiet and focused. You're very present. You're not attached to a future outcome. You're very still in the moment. And there's a sense of wonder about the whole thing. There's a sense of magic and joy in the process. And then the butterfly flies away, and you let it go, and it leaves you full for a time afterward. And there's something in that energy of love and wonder and presence that's very magnetic to our highest good. Anything that is of the energy of love is magnetic to our highest good. The minute that feeling of love and wonder shifts into attachment, in other words, going from the feeling of, oh, isn't that lovely, to, uh-oh, what if I don't get it? That's attachment, and attachment is rooted in fear rather than love, and fear is antithetical to all the consciousness work that we want to call in good things. It tends to shut us down and disconnect us from our inner guidance and disconnect us from that power of consciousness to call in what's really truly for our highest good.
Now, you have a delightful story in here about a young man, and it's in your chapter where you say miracles are natural. And he had been involved in one of your workshops, and his story was that he had decided to move to a big city. He was homeless, he was jobless, he was penniless, and he was friendless. But because of being involved in your class, he started affirming, I don't know what's going to happen, but I know it's going to be great. Tell us what happened with him.
Well, he didn't even do that as a result of my workshop. He told this in my workshop, and he was my teacher rather than the other way around for some time.
Oh.
He just went off to a big city, truly as an adventure, having no money in his pocket, no place to work, no friends, no place to live, and just kept affirming, I don't know what's going to happen, but it's going to be great. And one thing after another in these beautiful serendipitous coincidences came to being, where the minute he needed a place to sleep, somebody just gave him a place, he found a job, he found friends, he found really everything he needed just as he needed it. And his new adventure began. And interestingly, there was just someone who wrote to me who read that chapter, and she and her husband were working on the book together, and they did that exercise together. And they said they were actually having some financial difficulties at that time. They said that immediately after that, they came upon an income opportunity that they didn't know was available to them, that they found a way to scale back on their work hours and live on this new income source and start to pursue a career that had interested them for some time. And I heard another update from them. They actually were also able to let go of their very expensive, highly mortgaged underwater house and found one to buy for just $20,000 that
they
really
sake.
Love, and it's in a neighborhood that feels good to them, and they're completely living within their means with plenty left over and are really starting a new life at a time when they didn't see many options. They're a little bit older and just felt really pressured by life. So that's an update on that story.
Mm-hmm. In your book, you talk about the science of miracles. Then you also have a chapter on how we create our reality. Can you comment on those two topics?
Well, there actually is, you know, some of the premise of my book, I set the whole thing up as a dynamic group experiment so that it immediately turns readers into participants in a miracle-making experiment as soon as they begin reading. So it's a little bit different from your typical book. And it invites readers to bypass space and time to reach out in loving compassion to all other readers, wherever they happen to be in space and time. And the experiment involves focusing and directing this collective energy of love to see what miracles we can create for ourselves and for other readers and for the world beyond. So instead of having a private experience with the content, readers are having a spiritual experience with other readers. And the whole book becomes a giant prayer set in motion on behalf of every reader. And it's kind of a outlandish premise, really. And yet, all of these experiments that I set forth in the book are just new applications for what science has already shown or strongly suggested to be possible. So I'm far from a science writer, but I do give little bits and pieces of some of the research that is showing the incredible power that consciousness has to shape the world around us. You know, that isn't just metaphysics anymore. It really has a lot of research behind it from the scientific community. And what I guide readers through in this experiment is first off, just joining the experiment, really being part of this field of consciousness formed by all other participants. And then I take them into looking at how the outer world really does reflect our inner state. And, you know, if we want to start intentionally creating these wonderful, miraculous coincidences, I think it's also important to look at our connection to the unfortunate coincidences that we tend to want to call circumstances beyond our control. And taking it completely out of the paradigm of blame and shame. I don't think that blame and shame has any usefulness to mm-hmm. them. It's not that bad things happen because we did something wrong. It's that we interpret some circumstances as bad. We interpret some as good. Truly, I don't know that even those definitions are very useful. But we can, if we choose, we can look at the outer world as a source of information, to see something about what we've learned to expect from life. And these expectancies are often unconscious until we see them portrayed around us. And if we choose to look at them as such, we can start to get a glimpse of what goes on inside at a subconscious level, which gives us a little bit more power. So, for example, if I tend to live from crisis to crisis, I could just say, well, the world is out of control and I have no way to help this and I'm just a victim of circumstances. Or I could look at it and say, well, how have I somehow learned to expect the world to treat me this way, to always feel out of my control? How has that been programmed into me at some level, some point in time? It's usually when we were really young. And if I see it that way, well, now how can I start to change this so that this actually is more in my control?
Once now, you have exercise, one of many that's in your book, where you encourage people just to find a quiet space of some type and to do a visualization process, and you have them itemized out. Each component that you're wanting to emphasize is very, very nicely stated in this exercise so that one could say yes to opportunity. And I think that many times we might have conflicts in our lives because for some reason we need to grow through something. We need to get past something. And it's perhaps it's the level of fear, perhaps it's the level of ignorance, whatever it might be. And I don't know about anybody else, but I can recall a number of situations where they were doggone uncomfortable. And part of that is helping us to wake up, I think, many times to various aspects of life. And that's something that through the exercises you have in your book, that you want people to be aware of this. Now, with these exercises, some of them are meditations that can be long. Someone could actually read them into a tape recorder and then play them back to themselves if they wanted to. This is something that they could do, a recorder, or, you know, if you wanted to read it into your computer, however you wanted to do it. But it's a very nice book as you're going along, and you talk about tapping the field. And in one of the exercises that you have in this segment, you say to imagine the clear, bright energy of other readers of this book, past, present, and future, that are coming together. Now, that's a very nice imagery. Was this something that was given to you? And this is just right in the beginning of the meditation. When in tapping, as you say, the field, and entering into that thought process, that's a very nice image. One would not feel alone.
Yes, and one of the comments I've heard over and over from readers, first people will tell me of some wonderful miracle experience they have, and then they'll go on to tell me of this whole qualitative shift of suddenly feeling that they're just not alone anymore, that they're just so loved. And I've been doing group work of one sort or another for about 35 years, and I believe very strongly in the amplifying effect of group consciousness, that healing and transformation and all kinds of positive change just seems to happen so much more easily and so much faster in a group than I used to do individual counseling, and I just found that group work was so much more powerful than one-on-one work, even when people mm-hmm. had all of my attention. And what I've done in this book is just taken that a next step, and I've rooted it in science that really has shown that in consciousness and intention can transcend spatial barriers, and it can also transcend the illusionary limits of time. And there's a lot of really interesting research coming out around that. And if that's true, then there's nothing to stop us from intentionally joining with people across space and across time. So I have people imagine that we all are together, people who've read the book in the past, people in the present, people in the future, really an untold number of people, and that we can make a personal connection with all of these people. And I talk about this in terms of it creating a morphic field, which is a term coined by a modern-day biochemist, I believe he is, called Rupert Sheldrake. And he used that term to refer to an energy field formed by the memory of a species, by human systems of thought. You know, for example, a Catholic Mass that's practiced again and again and again and again over eons will create a morphic field of repetition, so that as one person enters into that ritual, even though they don't have hundreds of years of experience, they'll get the benefit of those people who participated in this Mass before them. And,
mm-hmm,
and working
that's
with
true.
That same idea, I've put out this intention that we are going to create a morphic field of intent around miracles, and that it's not going to be exclusively those who've preceded us, but because time is so illusionary, it can also include those in the future. And, mm-hmm. you know, I think the reason this can work is really simply because we're being imaginative enough to form the intention.
Well, you've also got a very good chapter on manifesting your heart's desires. You also have a section on helping people determine what it is that they want. And I think lots of times there's so many levels to things that we want that many times there is opportunity that comes in a guise that we would never have imagined would have been possible. And it's often better than what we would have expected. And this is something that I think is very hard for us to wrap our minds around. And I think the reason that that is the case is that we have culturally, and I think this is within just about any culture, gee, we want a certain amount of money, we want certain situations, and we don't know how to let go of whatever our vision might be. And our vision can only be as broad as perhaps we're able to conceive something of being. And if our experience is not that way, and we have an opportunity that's utterly magnificent that has all kinds of extensions to it, it can be very, very frustrating. We just don't know how to accept it. I love the story of someone that talked about an actor who had worked so very, very, very hard to be able to achieve a level of accomplishment. And there came a day when he was called by a particular agent, and this agent was going to put him right up front, and he decided to go boating instead of going the other way. He stepped away from an opportunity, and it's not good or bad, but many times what people say they want, they really don't want. How does someone get around that, just like that actor that said, oh, I want to have the top agent, I want this, I want this. Then when it came his way, he turned his back on it, went in another direction. How do you direct people?
Well, that's a big question, and there's a couple of different ways to answer it. On one hand, listening to our wants is a valuable process, because often in life we're trained not to expect too much, or we've had so many disappointments we're afraid to want too much. And learning to listen to our desires, it is a step in the direction of learning to listen to our inner guidance. And yet, to call that into our lives effectively, there's a way we need to be open to our excitement and passion, and then also be willing to let it go and give it over to God, in a sense, with this idea of this or something better. And I know a lot of people who work with manifesting techniques do that, and yet theoretically doing it and really doing it are two different things. So mm-hmm. effective manifesting work always has to start with that place of excitement and desire, like what is it that my heart is calling out for, identifying it, but then giving it up with an idea that whatever comes back is going to be perfect, and it may not look anything like my picture. It may look very different. Now, what I think you are talking about is when we really want something, and then we put up obstacles. We get in our own way. And that is a sign of conflicting agendas, that consciously we want something, and unconsciously there's some reason that we don't. It may be that we want success. We really do. Consciously, we just want it so badly. And yet some part of us believes that maybe it would be scary or burdensome to have people expect more from us. Maybe it would be devastating to have an opportunity and fail. Maybe it's on some level, feels better to always have the opportunity as a possibility unfulfilled rather than chance the risk of failing. And those are just a couple of examples. We tend to have an awful lot of these mixed agendas. In fact, any area of life, where we feel stuck, where we've exerted effort to try to make something happen, and it's just not happening, we can probably find a hidden agenda. And those tend to be unconscious. And the way, I think one of the exercises from my book you were mentioning was a series of questions I walk people through just to help discern what might be some of the hidden payoffs to staying stuck. Because if we can figure out how this condition of being stuck is serving us, then we can start to work with it. I mean, just to give you an example from my own life, many, many years ago, I started working with some of the spiritual principles of prosperity. And they really worked. I just called in a whole bunch of money unexpectedly, much bigger flow. And instead of going, oh, goody, this is great, thank you, God, I kind of freaked out. I got in touch with what an enabler I am. If anyone in my life didn't have money, I felt like I just had to give it to them. I had no boundaries whatsoever. I felt kind of guilty having more than my friends. It left me feeling separate from people. And rather than feeling happy with it, I felt really burdened. And I would never have guessed I would have felt that way until I actually had what I thought I wanted. Then, of course, I disappeared a lot of that new flow, and I took it down to an amount that was a little bit more than before but didn't leave a lot of excess that was burdensome. And I had to do a lot of personal work around being willing to say no to people and being a good steward of money, seeing money as a source of creative energy rather mm-hmm. than just too much.
Mm-hmm. Well, that, I think, is really... And I know we're just about out of time. I think your example is a very good one. You have a chapter in here on becoming a miracle maker, and there's so much more. Lynn, your book, Making Miracles, Creating New Realities for One's Life and for the World That We Live In, is a very thought-provoking kind of material, and it's very easy to go through. What is your website that people can go to, Lynn?
It's lynnwoodland.com.
I keep saying Woodward, and I'm sorry, Lynn Woodland. This is I've got something clicking in my mental department. Don't ask me why.
A lot of
but Lynn Woodland, Woodland. So it's lynnwoodland.com?
Yes.
Wonderful. Well, Lynn, it has been a delight having you as a guest. Thank you so much for being with me today. Making Miracles, Creating New Realities. I suggest if you're interested in doing this, if you're feeling stuck, this is a book you might want to add to your library, someone that could be a companion and a friend to you whenever you're feeling that maybe life is not working as smoothly as it should be. It's a good companion to have. I think you'd like it as an addition in your library. Again, go to lynnwoodland.com, lynnwoodland.com. Thanks again, Lynn, for being my guest. This is Donna Sebo. We're taking a break. We're going to be back in just a moment.
Are you taking too many oral pain pills and concerned about the side effects? Are you having trouble getting to sleep at night because of the pain? Well, I'm Lou Paradise. I had the same problems you have, cured my pain, eliminated pain pills and their side effects by developing Toprasin, pain relief and healing cream. Toprasin relieves pain without the side effects. It doesn't burn, it doesn't smell, and it doesn't stain. But don't take my word for it. Doctors, pharmacists, and pain specialists are using and recommending Toprasin and ending the suffering for thousands of people just like you. We know you hurt. We want to help. We are so sure that Toprasin will work for you, we offer a money-back guarantee. So if you want the pain relief without the side effects, ask for Toprasin. Toprasin is available at Duane Reade, Quick Check Pharmacies, and Wegmans. Ask for Toprasin or call 1-800-959-1007 for a store near you. That's 1-800-959-1007. Toprasin, the last pain medicine you'll ever need, and you can sleep on that.
Do you have children between the ages of 3 to 10? Do you love children's books and collect them? Then you'll want to know about God's Kiss, the award-winning illustrated children's book that has been enjoyed by families around the world. 15 beautiful illustrations by Pacific Northwest artist Ed Gedrose accompany this lovely story about a little boy named Johnny that will capture your heart and mind in a very special way. Multicultural, and non-denominational in content, it will become a family favorite that you and your children will want to read again and again. This book is available by itself through Amazon, or if you contact me, Donna Sebo, directly, you can get a personalized signed copy. There is also a talking book. You can order the talking book CD by contacting me via email, donna@delphiinternational.com, or by calling 253-582-5604. You can also visit my website, delphiinternational.com, to see more details. God's Kiss is a family classic that belongs in everyone's library. Get your copy now.
Hi, this is Donna. Welcome back. I don't know what the weather's like where you are, but our temperatures have been dropping. We were below freezing the other night, and so it's just that kind of mood that, especially with the holidays coming in, that you want to be in the kitchen baking. Well, I pulled out a recipe that I've been wanting to try for a long time. They're cherry chocolate bars. So have that pad of paper and pen handy, and I'll share this recipe with you. It's really an easy one. It's a little bit different, but oh my goodness, it's delicious. My husband took what I had made, fortunately, because we would be so fat we wouldn't be able to get out the front door. But man, what a way to go. I'm telling you, this is a great cookie recipe of type, but it's not baked like cookies. It's baked differently. So I'll be sharing that with you. And by the way, telephone lines are open. If you would like to call in and chat with me, I'd be delighted to light up your life with a little bit of intuitive insight. 888-627-6008. That's 888-627-6008. And all I need from you is your first name or your initial if you're a first-time listener. And just sit back, relax, let me tell you what I perceive about you. And then after that, you're welcome to ask a question about anything that you like. Well, dating in today's world, it has become really expensive, according to some people's evaluations. And I just had so much fun with this information, because I don't know of any generation that doesn't always have this concern. Well, it used to be at one time you'd take somebody out for a movie and maybe a hamburger afterwards, and it didn't cost you all that much. But now you go to a movie and it costs you $20 for two people. That doesn't include the gasoline, and that doesn't include, you know, if you're going to go get something to eat. Before you know it, you're spending a whole bunch of money. Well, I came across a survey of single adults, and this was an age range of 21 to 65 and above, really. And there was a difference between the men and the women, and it was fun because the people that are from the 50 to 60-year range, you know they're the fastest-growing demographic on dating websites? Can you believe that? I mean, my grandmother would never have believed something like that, but that's the way it is in today's world. And so many people are living so much longer. So a lot of things have changed in the world. Well, here is some information which I thought was interesting. When a man and a woman go out, who do you think should pay for the meal? Well, men, 37% of men think they should pay for the first date. Now, that's a big difference from, let's say, 20 years ago. The guys would have been like 75% was that, oh, the men always pay for the first date. Women, their attitude is 87% say that they should pick up the check in some cases, dependent on what the arrangement is. A lot of young people I know will even go Dutch. No big deal. So it's a big shift culturally between the men and the women. And then, as far as men are concerned, 51% of men spend more than $100 a month on dates. I don't know what they do, but they said this is the information they got. Now, 46% of women, their attitude is it doesn't matter how much the date spends on them. If they like the person, they're more impressed with the quality of time and how you spend time together. A lot of families, you know, they are saying, or young people are saying, well, let's go get a DVD and we'll watch a movie at home with my family. I know we've got a nice family that has some young people in it down the street, and that's what they do. They come home and they hang out at home. They have their shows. Sometimes they've got video games that they do, because they don't have a lot of money to spend. So they are not spending $100 or more a month on dates. When it came to spending $150 a month on a date, 29% of the men said they spend more than that. So men in general are getting more frugal. And 66% of women spend less than $50 a month on dates. So women are really conservative when it comes to spending money. And I was surprised to find that the average amount of money spent on Valentine's Day by a man is about $103. $103. And for a woman, it's about $51. It's amazing. And I just thought I would say, if you want to have a cheap date, I love this, that if you wanted to have a real cheap date, keep your first date brief. Have a coffee or meet maybe someplace that serves special appetizers during the happy hour, and you maybe can have a drink, but don't go and buy dinner. And this came as a tip from a woman by the name of Dale Coppell. She said, you're going to spend less and have an easy out if this is not the kind of person that you really want to spend time with. And when you work up to getting, you know, going out for a nice dinner, table for two, don't try to be over the top. Don't try to be expensive in your impressional or impression pattern. But they said, whatever you do, when you take your date out, male or female, you take your date somewhere, don't complain if they order the most expensive thing on the menu. Don't complain about the cost. And whatever you do, as a point of etiquette, you always leave your leftovers behind. That makes me chuckle. I remember working with a gal who was single, and she and her girlfriend, though they had jobs, it was really, really tight for them. And she said, when I go out on a date, I always take a doggy bag home with me so I have something for another meal. So etiquette procedures apparently have changed. I don't know what my status would be, but I remember this gal, Debbie, saying, I'm not leaving anything. If I have a steak, she'd cut everything in half, so half of her meal would go home with her. It was really something. But that's a point of etiquette. Now, if you are going to have a big night out, if you're going to be in San Francisco, dinner for two, bottle of wine, and a movie cost. This is going across the country. San Francisco, $230. Atlanta, Georgia, $211. Columbus, Ohio, $203. And Kansas City, Missouri, $193. Well, I'll tell you what. I think there are many things that one can do. You can have a lot of fun. And just, you don't have to spend a huge fortune. But I just thought those stats were interesting. And also the average cost of an engagement ring and research that was done, $5,749. Very interesting. So those are some stats for those of you that are in the dating game. That's a little bit of information there. Give me a buzz if you'd like to chat, 888-627-6008. That's 888-627-6008. December 3rd, there's an event coming up, and it is going to be held at the Ascension Foundation in Seattle. And I'm going to be giving the invocation as well as giving the first talk of the day. The program is going to be starting at 10 a.m. It's being held in Seattle. The address is 1222 South Weller Street in Seattle, Washington. And if you want more information about this, call 206-356-6356. And I'll be there from 10 in the morning until about 5, and I'll be available for many consultations while I'm there. And then there's another event coming up the 17th of December. Lots of things going on. Check out their website, ascensionfoundation.com, but there is going to be a lot going on, a lot of speakers, a lot of demonstrations of different types of intuitive ability. So if you're in the Seattle area, you might want to take time out on December the 3rd. Come on by, say hello, and we'd love to see you there. Then they've got a special event in the evening, and you can find out, again, all kinds of information regarding that by checking out ascensionfoundation.com. And you can also go to the ascensionintheLight@gmail.com and email them about the information. Also, for those of you that are hearing the Topperson commercial on the show, I want you to know this is one of the most phenomenal products I've ever come across. And if you would like to inquire into this, you can go to any of your big stores like your Fred Meyer's, et cetera, and you can find this. It's in the whole natural food area within your stores. But if you call them directly or you email them and you want to order something, they'll give you 30% off. All you have to do is say The Donna Sebo Show or put in DS for Donna Sebo 30, and they'll automatically give you 30% off of whatever you order. I swear by this stuff. I really do, as does my husband and many of our friends. And so I just encourage you, if this is something you want to explore, if you know of anyone that goes through a lot of physical discomfort, any kind of nerve damage, etc., check it out. Go to their website. Check it out, Topperson.com, and you'll find out more about why this is such a marvelous homeopathic remedy for discomfort. Now, I have a recipe here for you. These chocolate cherry bars, I just fixed them for the first time. They are incredibly good. Well, before we go on break, let me give you the ingredients, and then when we come back from break, I'll give you the directions. You're going to need 16 ounces of candied red cherries, and you're going to need 16 ounces of candied green cherries, and both of them need to be chopped. So just take them out of their container, chop them up real good, and just put them in a bowl. You're going to need 1.5 cups of pecan or walnut pieces. You can also use almond if that's a favorite nut, or macadamia nuts if you want. I love walnuts. But you have 1.5 cups of your favorite nut, 1.5 cups of flour, 1.5 cups of flour, 1 cup of brown sugar, 1 cup of brown sugar. You're going to need 8 tablespoons of softened butter, butter at room temperature. You're going to need 2 eggs. Have those at room temperature, too. 8 ounces of semi-sweet chocolate morsels. 8 ounces of semi-sweet chocolate morsels. And then 2 tablespoons of unsweetened cocoa powder. 2 tablespoons of unsweetened cocoa powder. And you need a teaspoon of vanilla. Teaspoon of vanilla. And 1.5 teaspoons of baking soda. And we're going to be taking a break, but I'll tell you what, when we come back, I'll give you the directions on this. And my husband, the event he took it to, the people just said, oh, these are wonderful, and there wasn't one left. So I'll give you the directions on how to fix it when we come back. This is Donna Sebo. Give me a buzz if you want to chat. 888-627-6008. That's 888-627-6008. We're going to be right back.
Are you concerned about nutrition? Do you work hard to eat right, try to feed yourself and your family nutritious food? Well, you'll want to know about glyconutrients. What are they? These are sugars that are present in nature. However, we're not getting them in our food anymore. Scientific study is proving that these sugars are necessary for all cellular and immune system function. Over 20,000 studies are conducted each year on glycoforms alone. These are the sugar protein structure that line each and every cell of the body. 4 out of the last 8 Nobel Prizes in physiology have been awarded for research in the area of cellular communication and how these sugars work in the body. This is Donna Sebo. Every day I bring to you information that will empower and light up your life. I would like to invite you to visit my website, DelphiInternational.com. and find out more about these glyconutrients. That's DelphiInternational.com. Go to my website, go to the left side of the screen, tap on the button that says glyconutrients. MIT's Technology Review, February 2003, states that glycomics is one of the 10 emerging technologies that will change the world. Education is the key to advancement of understanding and making our lives better. Visit my site, DelphiInternational.com. Go to the left side of the screen and tap on the button that says glyconutrients. I know it'll make a difference for you, as it has for me.
Are you taking too many oral pain pills and concerned about the side effects? Are you having trouble getting to sleep at night because of the pain? Well, I'm Lou Paradise. I had the same problems you have, cured my pain, eliminated pain pills and their side effects by developing Topperson, pain relief and healing cream. Topperson relieves pain without the side effects. It doesn't burn, it doesn't smell, and it doesn't stain. But don't take my word for it. Doctors, pharmacists, and pain specialists are using and recommending Topperson and ending the suffering for thousands of people just like you. We know you hurt. We want to help. We are so sure that Topperson will work for you, we offer a money-back guarantee. So if you want the pain relief without the side effects, ask for Topperson. Topperson is available at Duane Reade, Quick Check Pharmacies, and Wegmans. Ask for Topperson or call 1-800-959-1007 for a store near you. That's 1-800-959-1007. Topperson, the last pain medicine you'll ever need, and you can sleep on that.
Hi, this is Donna. Okay, here I gave you the recipe for the cherry chocolate bars, and you're listening to this and you're saying, Donna, my goodness, it has enough sugar in it, it'll put you over the top. Well, this is coming into the holiday season, and I don't know about you, but chocolate and cherries just seem to be a magical combination, and this recipe is just incredibly delicious. Now, what you want to do, you want to take a large cookie sheet, a jelly roll pan, and you want to just lightly coat it with butter. And you can just take a stick of butter and just go gently, just make a light amount of butter there. It's like less than a tablespoon, and it'll just cover the whole sheet. Now, you want to preheat your oven to 350 degrees. While that's heating, you're going to take your flour, your cocoa, and your baking soda, and you just whisk it together, put it in a bowl, setting it aside. And then in a bigger bowl on your mixer, cream the butter and the sugar until it's nice and fluffy. Then take your eggs, add one egg at a time, beating it, and your vanilla. And then you're going to want to stir in the flour. And I have a paddle on my mixer, and so I added the flour in increments. And your dough is going to be a very, it's like it's very firm, very, very stiff. And what you do, you then take and put in your candied fruit, your nuts, and your chocolate morsels. And you need to do this either by hand. I like to put maybe plastic gloves on, you know, like the surgical gloves, so I can mix things so that stuff just is easier for me to handle. And what I also did was put a little bit of oil on my hands, just like some olive oil or even vegetable oil, so that it's easier to work with the batter because it's very sticky. But this is a very, very dense batter. So once you've mixed all of the candied fruit in there and then you have the nuts and the chocolate chips, then you're going to take and put it into your cookie pan. Now, you can spread it really, really thin. And I found because it had a stickiness to it that I had to take the oil and rub it on my hands so that I could manage it. Otherwise, the dough was sticking on the hands. So when I did that, I noticed that it didn't entirely fill the cookie sheet. So I made it sort of like a square. It almost filled the cookie sheet, but not quite. Made it into like a square that had, it was maybe, about a half an inch thick, and patted it down, and then I put it into the oven. And in my oven, about 35 minutes. The recipe says 30 to 40 minutes. Well, I baked it about 35. 40 was going to be too long. And you take a toothpick or a bamboo skewer and then just check it to see if it's done. Now, remember, when you put it in to test if the batter's done, you're going to get chocolate chip. You're going to get the gooey chocolate. And then it'll continue cooking when you take it out. And then I went and I scored it. After it had been sitting for about 15 minutes, I took a sharp knife and I cut it, I scored it, and within an hour it was cooled, and I'm telling you, it was delicious. And this is the type of a cookie, they call them cherry chocolate bars, but to me it is just a real decadent cookie, and it's just awesome. No matter where you serve it, wherever you take it, people are absolutely going to love it. So just know that this makes a wonderful recipe. And if you didn't want to put in 2 pounds of, then just get a half a pound of the red cherries or a half a pound of the green cherries. And that can be less. But I'm telling you, it is out of this world. So I recommend it highly. It makes a wonderful gift for people. And after it cools, you want to make sure that you cover it, put it in a covered container, because they will dry out very quickly if you just leave them out on the counter. So they'll keep their moistness because of the wonderful ingredients that are there. It's just a great, great cookie. So anyway, I wanted to share that with you. I also wanted to share with you today, if you did, give me a buzz if you'd like to chat, 888-627-6008, a story about a wonderful dog. And this is something that periodically we hear stories about special animals. And this dog is named Maddie. And Maddie, well, she was in a precarious situation. She had developed a condition that was very serious. She was going to have her leg amputated. Otherwise, they're going to have to put her down. And this is a dog that had already gone through a lot of misery. She originally was found when she was 3 weeks old in a motel room. She'd just been left there. And a woman by the name of Lynn, who worked for the Humane Society in Central Oregon, when they brought this little puppy in, she just bonded with this dog. She absolutely fell in love with Maddie. And then, when she was just a baby, Maddie just was laying there. She wasn't doing anything. She wasn't responding. And when they checked her out, they found that she had a staph infection that had destroyed the tendons and ligaments in her left hind leg. And the only way they could stop it, she was a baby, the only way they could stop it was amputate her leg. Well, Lynn didn't know what to do, and other people were very concerned, and she said, okay, let's do it. Let's take a chance. And Lynn took Maddie home. Do you know this little puppy was going up and down the stairs within just a couple of days? She was happy. She didn't have the leg, but she didn't know that she couldn't move around. Well, she said, I was just overwhelmed with this dog. This dog was doing things that I didn't think she possibly could do. And there was a championship. She had started teaching her how to catch a Frisbee. And Maddie was just absolutely amazing. And she said, you know what? I'm going to enter her regardless. And people, when they saw Maddie competing, even though she was such a young dog, she was just amazing. And people were cheering her on when they realized she only had three legs. Well, she ended up coming in and won competition in seventh. And she won the highest jump competition in one other event she participated in. And the rules had always specified, you know, an able-bodied dog. Well, they changed the rule after seeing Maddie perform to three-legged dogs could enter if they wanted to. And she said, you know what? This dog is just amazing. And she decided that she was going to adopt her. Now, there's another part of this story that's quite significant, and it involves a little girl. A little girl whose name was Sushma. And this child was from India. She had been adopted. And she was missing a leg and both of her hands. And this little girl cried every single day. She was 9 years old. She would never be normal. She was a misfit. In India, it was bad enough. Here in the United States, she felt even worse. Well, somehow or another, Lynn got to know the family, and she introduced Maddie to her, and Sushma smiled for the very first time, because here the animal was able to do just about everything, and so Sushma realized that she had opportunities too. And Maddie has just had such an incredible influence on people. And that's what we need to remember. We're the masters of our fate. We are the captains of our souls. Our experiences are meant to be the highest and the best. I hope Maddie will inspire you. And you have a magnificent day. Wherever you go, whatever you do, realize you have a gift to give. This is Donna Sebo. Talk with you tomorrow. Same time, same place, and we're going to tell you how you can eat on $4 a day. Bye for now.
You have been listening to The Donna Sebo Show. If you would like a copy of today's broadcast, send $10 to The Donna Sebo Show, P.O. Box 97272, Tacoma, Washington, 98497-0272. Be sure to put the date of the broadcast in your request. If you are not able to be a part of today's program, join Donna and her guests Monday through Friday, and she will be here to take your calls. Thank you for listening and being part of our program. Have a wonderful day.